Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 286 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Georgia. Hi Georgia, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you very much. How are you?
I am good. Not bad. Not bad, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I went to say great and I thought, probably not great, so I'm going to take that back. And then I thought, it's a bit sad to take it back. And then I just got threw myself off. So here we are. I'm not bad, thank you at all. How are you, Anna?
I am good. Oh, sorry, where do I go with that? No, I'm good. I am good.
You're looking great with your new eyebrows today.
Thanks. I'm not going to lie. I do keep on looking at them. I'm just so impressed.
Like the opposite of zoom dysmorphia. She got, what is it called? What did you get? Microblading.
I got them microbladed because I have very fair eyebrows, and if I don't put a lot of makeup in, then I can't see them. And I also have like the, I know they're not thin, but I'm like, I feel like they're thin. And my intention for this year is be high maintenance to be low maintenance. So here we are.
Yeah, mine are microbladed. I haven't done them done for like 2 years, but they lasted really well. Yeah.
Yeah, because this is the thing. Steph told me, she got me onto it, because I was like, you'd never know.
You don't have to do anything apart from pluck a couple of little like strays, and then you just like, they just always look done. It's great.
Oh, I want them now. So many things that I want to just do to my face.
You have lovely eyebrows always, though.
Yeah, you have nice eyebrows.
Thanks. It's very annoying.
Thanks so much. When I went in to get them done last time, the woman, I normally get them threaded, she was like, oh, you've had your eyebrows laminated. And I was like, no, it's just my eyebrow product. She was like, oh, what is it? Benefit eyebrow product. She says it's amazing. She says it's so robust. Robust is not the word she used, but I know that's what she meant. So yeah, some Benefit in a silver tube thing. Mm-hmm. Highly recommend. Clearly, I love a compliment from someone who knows about makeup, hair, or beauty or skin. I'm like, thanks. That means a lot, because I could think that, but I'm a scientist, so I really don't have a clue. So I'll take it. Take the extra.
I would love a compliment from someone who knows something about it. I'll just keep waiting, I guess.
But you got great eyebrows, and now Anna knows about it. Tore off.
Team eyebrows. Like the T in ETPHD is for, isn't it? Eyebrows.
Yeah. Sure, let's go with that. I was saying the other day that I got the compliment of not anemic looking the other day, and I thought, that's nice. I'll take not anemic looking. I'm assuming she meant that I wasn't, I don't know, pale, or I don't know. Like, what does anemic look like? Pale.
Pale, yeah.
And I was like, do you know what? I'll take that compliment. I will literally, someone could scrape the barrel to find a compliment right in the bottom, and they throw it at me, and I'm like, thanks. Thanks so much. I'll take it. Easily pleased. I don't think that's a bad thing. Okay, let's get cracking with the question, shall we? Georgia, do you want to go first?
This is one of Roz's clients, and she asks, or they ask, how do you move on and make progress when you fear what others may think or notice?
I don't know if we did this last time or if it's similar, but we'll just answer it again, because I feel like Georgia will have something interesting to say. No offense, Anna.
No pressure.
I think a lot of this comes down to this idea, ironic after the conversation we've just had, that other people's opinions are more important than your own. Literally what I just said about myself, so that's very unfortunate. But when we put our idea of what's right or wrong or good or bad or helpful or unhelpful, we put the worth of that or the direction of that on the feedback from someone else. So when you're fearing what other people might think or notice, what, like, my question would be, and I understand what I'm saying here, is like, what does it matter what other people think or notice? Like, what, like, who cares? Again, I may have said this last time, but you know, what other people think of you is none of their business, none of your business. Easier said than done. But I think this is more of a developing the worth in yourself and developing what we would call like an internal locus of control, this idea of like coming from the from inside, what's important, viewpoints from the inside, values from the inside, trying to base your decisions on yourself and what matters to you, as opposed to anyone else, is the only way really that you can find peace and allow yourself to continue to progress in, you know, whatever direction it's in.
Yeah, I think if you bring in the analogy of the eyebrow compliment there, like in the 90s, it was super, do you know, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it was super fashionable to have very, very thin, like almost one hair.
Babe, that's coming back. That's coming back, apparently.
The up and coming generation, don't do it because you will ruin yourself. Like, I know so many people now that have to draw their eyebrows in. It's absolutely why I've had to have little bits of mine filled back in again, because it's like, oh, what with that trend? And then it was like crazy huge eyebrows, right? Like a Scouse brow. Mm. Like as you said, we have to kind of know what we want, what suits us, what our values are, what we're looking for, because if we're always trying to fit everything to somebody else, you're going to have no eyebrows left, I think, is the lesson. With the story.
Correct. And that's not a good thing, no matter what TikTok tells you, okay? It is not a good thing to not have eyebrows. Okay? We all know. As
except
we said.
Halloween, maybe.
Oh, possibly. I remember my boyfriend when I was younger shaved one of his off and I cried so hard because it was the worst thing I'd ever seen in my life. I was just like, I couldn't. Oh, it makes me actually dry heave even thinking about it now.
There was a trend when boys used to do that. You used to like put like a little slash even with their eyebrows to make it look really cool. Do you remember that? And then they all had the same one. And I bet it's not growing back. And there's a whole generation of boys our age, men our age now, who just have this weird bit of eyebrow missing.
Correct. I actually have seen people with hair loss who look incredible, who with like without eyebrows or without lashes or without hair, and they look incredible. Which I'm sure is not their focus, but you know, side note.
Hope that helped.
Okay, Anna, go for it.
Okay, moving from knowing something is true to believing it, i.e. I know that tracking is inaccurate. I know that people have maintained their weight long before it was invented, but I struggle to believe it and still feel a sense of panic when I'm not tracking something and that I'm wildly off what I think I'm eating. How do you get from knowing to believing?
I think that's going to come with practice, to give yourself the evidence that that's the reality and that's the truth, isn't it? It's like whenever we're learning to do something new, there is a level of doubt, because until we have seen this materialize, we don't know. So we have to practice that enough that we get the evidence to go, oh, I can believe in that now.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very hard to, like, if someone, I'm trying to think of an example. Someone said the sky is green. Why did I not think of any other colour? I was like, it's because I was looking out my window and it's so grey. It threw me off. If someone said to you, the sky is green, you'd be like, no, it isn't. No, that's not a good analogy, because that's never going to happen. Right. Say you live in the northwest of England where it is grey all the time. And someone said to you, the sky is blue. And you're like, you wake up every day and you're like, it's grey. Nope, it's grey. It's grey. I have to keep wearing my big parka. It's grey. You're never really going to believe that it's blue until one day you wake up and miraculously it's a blue sky day and it's the best day of your life. And you're like, oh, I never knew it existed, but now I've seen it with my own eyes. I believe it exists. And I think that was a fantastic analogy, first of all. And number two, like, it will happen for you. And I think there's an element of faith in a lot of this, faith in the process, faith in your coach, faith in yourself to continue to do things even when you don't necessarily see that straight away, and faith that things are changing. And just keeping that faith will be really helpful for you, because, you know, you're working with Anna, Anna's gone through this process hundreds of times before. So she's not going to lie to you, and that's obviously not what you're saying, but have faith in what she's saying to you of this will happen for you because you're showing up, you're doing the work. And then one day you'll wake up and it'll be a blue sky and you're like, God, I can't believe I ever thought this wasn't possible. And then that will be it. Okay. Any advice for being on the receiving end of people pleasing? I appreciate it comes from a place of kindness, but to me it feels frustrating. Is it just a case of talking and helping the person acknowledge it?
I was instantly, I'm like, no, I am that other person. No. Good question.
I'm just interested in what you guys are going to say because I find that quite difficult. Of a few family members and friends that are deep people pleasers, and on the receiving end, it can be quite frustrating because they can't just say yes or no. And I'm like, just give me an answer. Would you like to? And if you would, great, shall we? And if you don't want to, can you please just say so that I can crack on and go book this myself and I'll go and do it? It's the being in the waiting around. Sorry, Anna, it's not an attack. It's not you.
It's
You've never done this to
I'm like, oh my
me.
God, this is me. Why do you hate me, Joe?
It's so true. It
It's
is, but it is so true because you do get frustrated and I get frustrated too. And I'm like, just tell me what you want. And then you're like, no, that's not helpful. Pull it back. But you also, I think it's hard not to, especially when you slip into coach mode, it's hard not to slip into like a life coaching thing of like, I understand that you think that that's what I want you to say. But really, if you come back to yourself, what would you really like to say? What do you really want? It can, obviously, I would never speak like that to someone, but it can be quite natural instinct to kind of go more into like the over-explaining and overcompensating kind of way as a coach or a fixing type of mentality or fellow people pleaser to kind of, you don't want to, yeah, it's, I think it is frustrating. I think, I don't even think it's talking and helping them acknowledge it. I really don't think it has to be that deep. Otherwise, you're acknowledging your own, you're acknowledging theirs, you're just a lot of acknowledgement and talking, and that's quite energetically draining. I would probably more just say, like, kind of what you were saying, Georgia, of like, I would just say, is that actually what like you definitely want, or do you feel like you're doing that because you think that's what I want? And I would probably just lay out on the line like that. No need to bring up any pathologizing, no need to kind of name it. Because we're not here to teach other people things. Well, I mean, unless we're in a particular role or job where we're actually teaching people, that's not what I mean.
I asked my mum because we were both, obviously, we're both people pleasers and we were struggling what to do tomorrow night, struggling to decide. I just ended up saying to her, I was like, so what's your gut like telling you? Because neither of us are going to make a decision, or we could just flip a coin. And she was like, maybe flip a coin. of course, you don't want to.
Oh my God, you two would drive me absolutely bonkers. Being
Yeah, we
like
don't
trying to
get
make a plan
along.
for you two, I'd be like, just, no, stay at home. Don't want anything to do with you. Okay, Georgia, question.
One of Danai's clients, what can I do when I find myself in this drama over and over again? Quote, I have to take care of everything, do everything by myself. There is so much to do, everything gets stuck on me, kind of drama.
Oh, I'm going to pause you right there because can I just take responsibility for the fact that I messed up on the last podcast and I, so for reference, people listen to the podcast, Lynn is excellent at admin. She's probably going to shout at me if she hears this. She did a new spreadsheet for all of our client questions and it was very, very helpful. And what I did, of course, was use the old one. And so therefore, the questions that Georgia has asked are questions that we have answered before that I deleted on the old spreadsheet and not the new spreadsheet. So I really, really apologize.
Oh, okay.
It's my fault. And I think that the next question you should ask, Georgia, is a question on row number 8.
Right, okay, habits one. Okay, should I just start again from
Go
here?
for it.
Okay, so back to one of Roz's clients' questions, habits and how to actually remember to do them. I cannot seem to build in the deep breaths before a meal. The last few days, I even started my day off writing in my journal and writing down which meal I was going to do them before, and then I just still forgot every single day until it came to marking my habits in the app, and then I would remember. I'm quite frustrated with myself about this one.
So one of my clients who, this isn't related to breath work before meals, but just breath work in general, we're trying to make it more of a habit, just because she's in Zen girl era. This is what 2024 is for her. And she knows how great it is for her, and she's great at using it in the moment, but just wants more of that feeling. So she's just set reminders on her phone. And maybe that's something potentially you could do, because you know roughly, I'm guessing if you're following the meal guidelines, you know roughly when meals might be. So just set a couple of reminders, alarms, or whatever's going to be most helpful for you, to give you a little prompt, or some of the habit apps as well. You can set up at quite specific times to just, I mean, no like audible, just a visual reminder on your phone to take a deep breath.
Yeah, love that. I think a lot of my clients do the same if they're struggling to remember something, which makes sense, right? Because sometimes when we're talking about a pause or a breath, it's remembering to not do something. And that's quite hard to do. It takes a bit of practice. So having a reminder is super helpful.
I'm going to bring in James Clear, which we don't really talk about James Clear much, but he does talk some good sensory habits and stuff. And he says how to create a good habit. I just Googled this because I couldn't remember the order. And make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. So it's cue, craving, response, reward. make it obvious, like how, like breathing before a meal, if you've lived a life of not being mindful, is not necessarily going to be the most obvious thing. So how can you make it more obvious? Maybe you put a post-it note on your cutlery drawer that's like, remember to take a breath. Make it attractive. You just don't want it to be like, I'm not going to do 10 breaths. This kind of ties into attractive and easy. You're just going to do 2 breaths. It's not a big thing. Make it satisfying. Maybe you give yourself like a reward. So your reward is you get a more mindful meal. You definitely don't want to reward yourself with like, I reward myself with food. We're not going into like the punishment and reward of food situation. But if you think about what is the cue, like, what, how can you crave it, or how can you make it attractive? Response, i.e. making it easy, and reward, make it satisfying. Think about those four. If you want to learn more about that stuff, then just Google James Clear, like habit, how to create a good habit, and you can learn more about that sort of stuff. But yeah, and I think not being hard on yourself, like ticking them off at the end of the day is great. I would say you're probably, you've said in your question, I know that when I look back at them, I remember I haven't done them. So you know if you did them every day, you'd probably remember to do them. So the question is, why do you not already tick it off every day? Maybe you generally are really busy because you forget to do that part. So it's like, okay, well then maybe we need to move on to that and say, okay, we're going to create a habit of checking these things off after dinner. And then you go through the same thing again of like, how can I remind myself to do that? How can I make that appealing? Aside from food, so maybe you do it whilst you're watching your favorite show, or something like that, or having your favorite drink. How can I make it easy, i.e. is it easy to do it, like we have it as easy as we can on the Apotheo app, but maybe you have a different way of tracking it, and then how can I make it satisfying?
But also, you're already journaling in the morning and you've said that you're going to do it your evening meal, so maybe if you're journaling in the morning, do it with your breakfast. So you're kind of stacking those two things together, or journal before your dinner and remind yourself then that's when you're going to do your breath, and then it's right after journaling, you're like, oh yeah, here I am.
Three. Anna.
So this client is working to restore her cycle and has said, I don't feel like I am restricting anymore. I eat regularly and make sure I have carbs, protein and fat in every meal. I feel satisfied after my meals also, but I feel like I have major food preoccupation. As soon as I finish my meal, I think about what time I'm going to eat my next and what I'm going to have. And I think about breakfast the second I wake up. Do you think this will go away over time?
So, great awareness. A couple of things. One thing I would say is, just because you're eating a mixed macronutrient meal doesn't necessarily, and you think that you feel satisfied, doesn't necessarily mean that you're well fueled. And some of the, obviously the work that we do with ETPHD is working on hunger and fullness, and what can happen when you have HA or when you are in a larger body or when you struggle with binge eating is that you get dysregulation of your hunger hormones. So your hunger and fullness signals are not necessarily super accurate. So you might feel like you're satisfied and that you're not hungry, but you may still not have eaten sufficiently in terms of energy intake to, if you're trying to regain your cycle, you probably not necessarily, but you're probably looking to gain a little bit of weight. And so you will usually have to eat past fullness as it stands, even if you are super regulated with your hunger. So sometimes being a bit more objective with what you're eating, how regularly and how much, can be quite helpful. You do that either by like randomly tracking, if you're not tracking, maybe tracking for a day, or making sure that you're tracking like body change in some way. I don't mean getting preoccupied with it, but I just mean making sure that you are going in the direction of body fat gain. That's the number one thing for the majority of people with HA recovery, is body fat gain. So just being mindful of that, and that over time you will find that your hunger regulation improves, and that as a result of that, some of your food preoccupation will go down. But then the other thing is, when you work on a relationship with food, like for sure, when you start thinking about, you naturally start thinking about food less and less. I say naturally, once you do the work, right? You start to think about food less and less. But the other side of that is that you then need something to fill that space with. And sometimes you have to be active and fill in that space. So it might be that for you, food and body preoccupation filled like a hole that maybe you had that you weren't necessarily aware of, like maybe you're bored in your job or bored in your relationship or just bored, or you know, it could be so many things, and food and body preoccupation kind of filled that hole. If you think, one of the tools that we use with ETPHD is you're like the headspace task, where we ask people to like draw out a pie chart of how much time they spend thinking all about food in their body, and then like career and joy and whatever else is important to them. And then we'll say, okay, well, can you draw that pie chart again with what you think you might like it to look like? And what three tangible things can you do to change that? It's a lot easier to add things in than to take things away. So maybe you look at, okay, how can I actively spend more time having fun? How can I actively spend more time building social connections or working in my career? Maybe doing some CPD. And actively bringing new things into your life, it's very hard to be preoccupied by food when you're obsessed with what you're doing in terms of like what you're learning or the, you know, the meeting that you're having or something like that. It's a lot harder to then be preoccupied by the food side of things. Okay. Are there any other ways you'd recommend to manage a healthy change in body composition during pregnancy outside of the NHS? X amount of weight expected to change.
Oh dear, Amelia's just having a coughing fit.
Sorry, I'm just gonna check.
So I was actually talking to you about this, wasn't I, in terms of a client of mine had panic because the NHS had told her that her baby was measuring on the small side when the mother was a very small woman and the father was very small also. So it's like, oh, where is the logic in this side of things? Like, I know that there is an expected amount of weight gain and expected average size of baby, but
it's really hard because the NHS or any health body, they have to give reference ranges. Like for anything else, they give reference ranges to cover a large, like usually like 95% of the population, and it can be helpful. The way that NHS ones I think are set out is that they go by BMI, and then they say, if you've got this BMI over the course of your pregnancy, this is kind of what we're looking at in terms of weight gain. But what they don't of course take into consideration is your starting point, which part of, you know, where about on the BMI range that you actually are, your muscle mass. People will lose muscle mass with pregnancy just in terms of being able to either eat enough protein or train consistently, which is going to mean that you gain less weight potentially. That's not taken into consideration. And also, I don't think, from what I'm aware, they break it down into trimester by trimester. Some people can lose weight in the first trimester because they're really sick. Some people can gain weight because it's the only way that they're not sick. And then, you know, in the second trimester, that might shift, and in the third trimester, that might shift again. And so I think that, especially in the beginning when you're pregnant, you're looking at all of this stuff and you're a lot more aware of all of this information, you're kind of, you go with, okay, well, I've gained this much weight in this trimester. That must mean that if I carry on like this, I'm going to be on the higher end of this. Is that wrong? Or I'm going to be up beyond that. And is that wrong? And, you know, that's not indicative of your entire journey. It's indicative of your last 12 weeks.
Yeah, I was talking to a client who's actually due any day now. It's quite exciting. But and she was saying, similar to what you were saying, Amelia, in that you've got all of these kind of guidelines or expectations, and then you feel like you're doing it wrong if you don't meet that, or the worry, and then she's like, and the just general uncertainty because you don't know how you're going to feel day to day and can't plan ahead, or don't feel able to plan ahead as well.
Yeah, I think in terms of specifically this question, excuse me, I was like, should I mute myself there, or people think I've just gone silent? Sorry, I was just sneezing. I'm on form today. Imagine what it'd be like if this podcast was actually edited all the way through. Gosh, it'd probably be a lot shorter. Sorry, everyone. I think in terms of managing, like, healthy change in body composition, i.e. being mindful of a healthful change in body composition, I think you need to take the emphasis away from weight, which is hard when every single appointment you go to, they weigh you and then they're like, oh, okay, they make a judgment on that. Usually, hopefully, they don't actually judge that to your face. But I think you need to take the pressure off that outcome and focus on the processes of, am I doing my best to, so this person was exercise regularly before they were pregnant. So am I doing my best to exercise regularly where possible amongst the fatigue and potential nausea and how I'm feeling and energy levels, etc.? Am I exercising to what I feel is a regular amount compassionately? Does my diet contain sufficient protein and sufficient fruit and vegetables and whole grain and fiber, again within the context of what is actually feasible for me? And I would like to also say that this, like, if you've just come out of your first trimester, your reflection of what you're eating is so skewed because you're thinking, oh, well, I've gained this much weight, and in the last 12 weeks, I wasn't really able to exercise that much because I was so tired and so sick. And actually, I only ate beige food because it was the only thing that didn't make me nauseous and all these things. And so you can fall, especially when you're aware of food and nutrition, you can fall into like the, oh my God, I've been so unhealthy, or that's going to lead to weight, like excessive weight gain or whatever it is. And it's like, take the pressure off yourself, look at yourself as a whole person and think, I am a fit and healthy person. I've done all of these things before. And I will continue to do these things now that I'm a little bit more able to do it, that I don't want to vomit every time I stand up. So I think try and take the pressure off that and look at the, for anyone, look at the processes more than the outcome. And of course, if your weight goes up exponentially and, you know, the midwife or whoever raises it to you, then that's something to then think, okay, let's reflect, let's look at any, like you would with anyone, is there snacking coming in? Am I kind of eating a little bit more chocolate at night or whatever it is? Do I want to be a bit more mindful of that? But I think at this point, unless it's flagged back to you, it's not something that I would be overly concerned with. Georgia.
Oh, excuse me, I'm just going to need to expand that box because I think some of the question is going to move. Oh, it's still going. Okay, hang on, sorry, I'm actually going to move my laptop out of the way so I can see the rest of that screen. It's a really long question. I might just give that a new line.
Skip
Yay, okay, got the whole thing now, that's great. Sorry, this is one of Steph's clients' questions. So, what are some ways you could work on building trust in yourself and other close friends and partners? How can you work on shifting your perception and assumption of others to be more along the lines of people are generally good from people cannot be trusted in as much as I could safely be vulnerable, because there are too many factors that influence their actions, behaviors, to trust that they will be respectful or kind or whatever.
Interesting. Good question. It's very, like, first of all, I think it's important to say it's very important to say, like, if you have evidence that of one from one specific person that they've broken your trust, it's totally understandable with that specific person to feel like, can I trust that person again? And I would look at, if it's one specific person, you know, is that someone that is deserving of your trust again, is one thing. But that's sort of a side note. Like, I think that as you build compassion towards yourself and other people, you do develop that compassionate mind of understanding or assuming that people are doing the best they can from where they are. And that's something, you know, I've said quite a lot in the podcast before, of I really do try my best. It's not easy to see everyone from that standpoint of that's their best they can from where they are. And, you know, I've had people cheat on me and break my trust many times. And I definitely probably fall more into the easy forgiveness, keeping people around longer than I should stay. And I don't think that's helpful either, by the way. This has got issues all in itself. But for me, it's about, again, I've said this on the podcast before, but not necessarily knowing. Trust is not about necessarily knowing that someone's not going to do something to break your trust, but it's about saying, I'll be okay even if they do, because I can support myself, I can make the changes that I want to make. So I think it's about learning to develop that trust in yourself that you'll be okay. And then the trust for other people becomes easier. But I don't think you should just give your trust to anyone. I do think people should earn your trust. And I don't think that should be, like, we should feel guilty for not trusting everyone and for trusting people, you know, taking time to trust people. What do you think?
So the second part of that question was, like, I'm beginning to be more vulnerable, yeah? And, like, having that trust in people that you can do that and they'll respect you, and kind of similarly to what Amelia said on the question that was around, like, the tracking side of things, and you need, well, and you, Georgia, like, you need to start building that evidence that you can allow yourself to be a little bit vulnerable. And I often kind of do this with clients, because I think most of us listening might relate to just struggle with vulnerability in general, but particularly if maybe there is that, don't know if I can trust someone, like, okay, well, let's start, like, doesn't need to be 10 out of 10 vulnerability, but can you start with the 3, like, conversation and see how they respond, and then start building the evidence that, okay, I can be open with people, I can share vulnerable stuff with people, and it goes down okay. Like, I know that I can trust them.
Interestingly, I agree with all of that, but just to give, like, an opinion from the flip side as well, and this is just something that came up for a conversation in therapy a few times over the last year or so, is that, like, you know, most people are good most of the time, but those that aren't, sometimes we struggle to trust our intuition at first, and we just assume that, you know, we can't trust our gut feeling on things. And I would say that the times when I've thought, oh, for some reason I've just had a strange feeling about someone and I couldn't tell you why and I couldn't describe it or be very specific, but I've just had a thought of, like, I am just going to keep a few more boundaries around this person or not spend so much time around them, that years down the line I've been like, oh, okay, interesting, this was there. And I have become, as I've become more trusting in myself and in my intuition and in my gut feelings, I'm able to trust that more easily. It makes it easier for me to give trust and give vulnerability to other people, because I know that I can trust when my body reacts and tells me there's just something off. And I think, again, that's going to come with practice. It doesn't just come overnight. But the more you start to discover in this process, like, who you are and like leaning into some vulnerability and into some trust, you'll know a little bit more easily when to kind of say, no, this is someone I shouldn't really be as vulnerable around, and know when it's okay to be like, I can lean into this and I can nurture this and I can grow this relationship with some vulnerability.
Yeah, I love that. And I think with like trusting your gut, obviously we for so long we're like women, we've been told we're too emotional, and that like gut instinct has kind of been like, what's the word I'm looking for, like shoo-shooed, is that the right word?
I mean, it works.
I love shoo-shooed. It's like a cat.
My bad. Keep that, okay? For so long, it's kind of been brushed off that we, like, it's kind of like, what's intuition? Why would we use that? Especially if you're quite a logical person. But I think, you know, whoever you're working with, like with ATPHD, you know, we do a lot of somatic work. And one of the benefits of reconnecting to your body in that way is that you start to recognize when your body is like, oh, there's something not right here, whether it be danger, whether it be attachment, whether it be anxiety, whatever it is, you start to feel that more in your body and you're more in tune with it, and then you can act on it a little bit more. And I think sometimes if you've been, and I would say this is definitely where I was at way in the past, of like suppressing feelings for a long time, maybe you've been overeating, you know, you've been binge eating, or you've been restricting or over exercising, and you've been suppressing all of that, you might think, I don't have a gut instinct, I don't know. You don't really know what that gut instinct actually feels like. And again, the more you connect with your body, the more that will start to feel like more natural instinct, and you'll feel more trusting of it. Okay, let's do one more question.
How do you manage your emotions when upset/angry? I'm often aware that I'm feeling these things, but don't know what to do about them/feel overwhelmed by them.
How do you manage them in the moment? Sorry.
Yeah, I just cry. That's what I do. Yeah. When it's overwhelming, sometimes it's just like, I just need to cry, and then I'm kind of like, oh cool, I've got it now. Like I saw a post on social media the other day, and it was something about like sometimes when you feel angry you cry, and it's just because there's a lot of emotion coming through and you need to cry to kind of process it. But there's nothing worse than crying when you're angry and someone being like, oh, you're getting upset, and it's like, I'm not upset, I just have to, I'm angry crying, don't hug me. I just need to get this out. And then I feel like after that I'm like, oh okay, I can deal with this now. Like particularly the next few days, like PMS week for me, I'll probably cry a bit uncontrollably, but then afterwards be like, oh yeah, that's good, and then I can kind of carry on. So sometimes I think when something's overwhelming, I just need that release, which is just a good old ugly cry somewhere.
Yeah, but
and
like
being out public would be great.
Well, we've all been there. Yeah, you're right, like, but crying is self-regulation, right? It's a way of your body trying to regulate itself. So I think that's the key of, if I'm emotional in the moment, I will do something that allows me to almost sit with that but not let it feel overwhelming. So I'll go and sit under my blanket just for 5 minutes and just like feel whatever's coming up. Maybe it'll be an hour depending on what that emotion is or the intensity of that emotion. I think that like we talk a lot about feeling your feelings and emotions and things, and I think that it is important to note that it's not always going to be appropriate for you to be able to do that in the middle of the day when you're at work or things like that. And what I don't want to do is kind of guilt people into not feeling their feelings immediately and going to cry and, you know, sit under a blanket and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when they're in their office. Like, of course that's not possible, but maybe at the end of the day you sit in the car just for 10 minutes and you allow that feeling to come up and just allow it to move through your body and just see how that feels, whether that induces tears, whether that, you know, you laugh anxiously, whether you feel like your breathing goes up. Just notice it and then allow yourself to do some sort of regulatory tool to move through that again, whether that be tears, whether that be breathing, whether it be a little bit of self-soothing or singing at the top of your lungs to something, whatever it is that allows you just to regulate, I think is how I would recommend.
Mm. Yeah, I like, for me, it's noticing how like how the feeling shows up in my body, because when I think angry, I often need some kind of movement, which is why I've not done Roz's Shake the Dust, but I found Shake the Dust, and that's been great when I'm feeling a bit angry, just to like, I don't know, get it out. That's more jazz hands, isn't it? But then also thinking like, we know that particularly those sorts of emotions, they're the ones that we shouldn't be feeling, be that because they feel uncomfortable, be that because we're women and women shouldn't be angry. But get curious as to, okay, well, they're showing up, like, what are they trying to tell me? What's my body trying to tell me that I need? Anger might be to put some boundaries in place and then go about doing that.
Yeah, I think the key is really like not just thinking, oh, I feel like I need to get rid of it. However, you can sit with it and not get rid of it immediately, and I don't mean getting lost in it, then you're doing a great job. Again, there's not always going to be the time. You're not going to want to cry in a work meeting. Well, maybe you will. Maybe you have that type of workplace. That's fine, but you know what I mean.
Or if you're very efficient, you can do what I did the other day, which is I went to see Mean Girls at the weekend and just cried through the advert because every advert was too emotional. Every trailer was just too much. And I was like, oh, and then kind of like laughed through the film and was like, oh, good job done. Leisure time and emotional regulation.
That's
Time to
genius.
go home.
Oh, it is funny. I'm obsessed with, I just binge watched the first series of The Traitors. If you haven't watched it, then have you watched it?
No.
It's on my list after you and Steph keep banging on
Oh
about
my God, it's so good. I've only watched the first season. If anyone haven't watched it, just persevere. First episode or two, you're like, don't know these people, whatever. Honestly, it's actual addictive, scientifically addictive. But I cried at that. So basically like a quiz, not quiz show, but like a show, a contestant show with real people in it. And I'm like, oh, he needs the money. Crying away. I'm like, this is
it.
pathetic. You're pathetic. And yet continue to do it. Wherever your outlet is, embrace it. I see, and watch The Traitors. Okay, thanks both so much. Thanks everyone for the questions. Keep them coming in. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.